I want to thank Alexander and the other organizers for inviting me. Thank you all for coming out on this misty Toronto morning. A little bit cooler than it was in Chicago, and I didn't know I was. I thought I was coming here for the good weather, but it's great to get from LaSalle Street over to Bay Street here. I'm going to talk about optimal portfolios, and I started off pretty ambitious in terms of the title here, Estimation Error and Unknown Returns in Large Numbers of Assets. I'm going to spend most of my time, in fact, almost all of it, talking about estimation, but I will mention those other things in terms of non-normality and dealing with lots and lots of assets as well. But it's a topic that I think is sort of fundamental, that whenever we do optimization, we have to estimate something, whether it's parameters for a distribution, whether it's parameters for the objective function, whether it's different kinds of constraints and how constraints relate to whatever the things we're investing in are. All those things have to be estimated in some way, and we don't have that much data to go on. So how can we sort of build models with few observations and make them, in some sense, robust, some sense responding to the environment? So that's sort of the central theme. Okay. So let me start. So what I am going to talk about portfolio optimization, basically allocating assets across a number of different asset classes. It's difficult. For one thing, you first have to make sure that you're consistent. And consistent, I'll give you a sort of example of what happens when you're not consistent. But consistency can sort of create nonsensical answers. And it's very easy for an optimization problem to present something that doesn't make any kind of sense. The next thing is, when we have large numbers of things that we're trying to, let's say, just make decisions about, there are many parameters that we have to estimate, and that just makes it easier to come up with these nonsensical answers. Besides that, our observations are probably from something that's dynamic, that's not stationary. So every time we look and we try to make an observation, we're getting a sample of something different. And then, as I said, there's also non-normality. The other problem that's sort of inherent in optimization is we're always trying to get optimal. So that means we're sort of driven towards extremes. And when you go towards extremes, that sort of naturally focuses your interests or focuses the decisions that the model tends to on what are really rare events. So anything that's sort of either a rare event or maybe just an error in what you've created in your model is going to be a focus for the optimization. And so you have to take care that you don't have those rare events or what are really estimation errors drive everything. And even though we have some nice convergence results, and a lot of us have written papers about these convergence results, most of them are asymptotic, and those asymptotic results don't really apply most of the time. And even when you come up with something that might apply, it has some constant that if you were to try to estimate that constant, either the constant wouldn't really tell you anything or you aren't able to estimate it. So there are a lot of things that are difficult in creating these models and making sense of them. Okay. So this is an example. I've shown this example a number of times, so those of you who have seen it before, I apologize, but I like it just because it sort of illustrates the point quite directly. I just put up a standard Markowitz portfolio, minimized variance subject to some constraint on return, and decide on the allocation of to different kinds of asset classes. I gave this example. I like to use this example, of course, in class. And when I was teaching at the University of Michigan, I had gone to the chief investment officer, who's responsible for, right now it would be $7 billion. Well, I don't know. Maybe it was $7 billion an hour ago. Maybe $6 billion today, right now. Responsible for something on the order of $7 billion in investments in the endowment. And I said, you know, could we use what you use to come up with these allocations across different asset classes? And he said, sure. So he gave me this correlation matrix, which I have up here. And it's across different kinds of asset classes. This is domestic common stock, small caps, international common, emerging markets, absolute risk, venture capital, et cetera. And he gave me estimates of what they estimated for return, what they estimated for standard deviation, so I could create a covariance matrix. And I thought, well, this would be great. I'll give this to my class, and my class can come up with what the asset allocations should be for a Markowitz model, and then they'll learn how this great chief investment officer for this very large fund is making these decisions. So I put this into Excel just to check, and I came up with this answer. I wanted to get a 10% return, and I got a negative 10 to the 19th variance. So wait, a variance? How did I get a negative variance? So the matrix that he gave me wasn't positive definite. So, looks like an innocent enough matrix, except, gosh, there are some negative correlations in here. But it turns out that matrix wasn't positive definite. And I went to him and I said, so how did you estimate this? He said, well, different parts of my team estimate different parts of the matrix. Right? So someone's responsible for coming up with these numbers, and someone's responsible for coming up with those numbers. And we put them all together. So a lot of people create, and I thought, I can't believe this. This guy's, he's working at the University of Michigan. He has $6 billion under management, and he's not using a consistent time series to estimate covariance. I thought, this is incredibly unusual. No, it's not. A lot of people do this. So a lot of people come up with sort of crazy estimates of correlations and covariances. So I've seen a couple of papers where people have gone and looked in the literature and come up with covariance matrices that are actually in the literature that are not even positive definite. So there's a big problem, and one of the reasons I said, well, why did you do this so inconsistently? So, well, we only had a little bit of data for emerging markets, so we didn't have that much to go on. But we had a lot of data for small cap and domestic common stock. So they were trying to use, and we thought we're supposed to use all the data we have, right? So, he had sort of good intentions. It just they didn't think about, are you doing something that's actually really consistent? And as I say, I think this happens more often than we might think. Okay, so we have a problem here. We have a large number of things to estimate. In this example, it's basically I had n assets. I didn't have that many constraints, but in general, you're going to have to estimate, even if it's just a linear model, you're going to have to estimate something, at least the number of variables, the number of constraints you might have. Any kind of small deviation in those estimates is going to lead you to something that doesn't really make sense. And if you have anything that's non-normal as well, when just using the mean variance kind of setup, we may be driven really far from something optimal by following that as well. So the motivating question here is, how can we construct large models that yield consistent results and do it with some kind of high probability? So that's sort of the goal of all this work. Okay, so I'm gonna put it on a more abstract basis and consider it in the form that I usually talk about, which is as some sort of stochastic optimization model. So I'm making a decision here. So these are the allocations to the asset classes. I've got some uncertainty here that's represented by this vector xi, which you can think of as having all of the randomness in the model, in this case the returns on the different investments, and then some objective function. And unfortunately, I don't get to sort of decide on what the distribution of xi is. All I really know is what I've observed. So all I have are these observations about these returns. And this was the problem for the CIO, in that he was trying to use all this information and plug it all somehow into this model, even if they weren't consistently arranged such that he came up with a, a, a valid covariance matrix. So typically what people do is, in this case, at least to make it consistent, typically people just take an average, assume that the observations you have are just like some sort of random sample, and just average the function of the object, or average that objective at whatever decisions you have, and for whatever those random observations might be, and come up with a solution here. So you get a solution to this problem, which is often called the sample average approximation in stochastic programming literature. You take a solution to this problem, which is just averaging over the observations that you have, and then try to relate it in some way to the model that you're actually really interested in, but that you can't actually observe. So one thing I want to do is to talk about, well, I've got this data, right? And maybe the way he did it and that just coming up with those correlations, maybe that's not the best way to use those observations. Maybe there's other ways that you can still use the data that you have, but to come up with a consistent covariance matrix, but use it in a better way that would give you a more consistent, more reliable answer. Okay. Well, there's some good news about that there are these results that are asymptotic, so that if I had a lot of those observations, then I'd get some kind of results that might look something like the central limit theorem. So sometimes you get some sort of multivariate normal, so that if you had lots and lots of samples, lots and lots of observations, assume, of course, everything's stationary and that's not varying over time, but then you might be able to come up with some multivariate normal, might be able to actually estimate something like a confidence interval about optimality. Sometimes, however, that doesn't necessarily happen in all optimization problems. In fact, usually what happens is you get some sort of projection of the multivariate normal, even if you are in this asymptotic regime, a projection of it onto whatever constraints you have. Sometimes you're really lucky in that projection ends up just being a single point. So there's just one, in this case, it would just be one allocation across those asset classes that's actually optimal, and if you had enough observations, you'll end up exactly at that single allocation. But a question here is, when does this actually start to occur? So this is, you know, I knew that this is these asymptotic results would apply, but when do they apply? How many observations do you really need to have? And do we have enough in the data that would allow us to use those, let's say, central limit kinds of results? Okay, well, there's some other results that actually apply even more generally, and that just say that, well, the probability of being far away from an optimal solution in terms of expectation, probability of being farther away from optimal than, say, some epsilon is something that's going down exponentially in the number of samples here. So it's some parameter A1 times an exponential to a minus another parameter beta times the number of samples. So the probability of being any distance away from optimal is actually going down exponentially. And the same thing's true about the distance from an optimal solution. So the probability of being more than epsilon away from an optimal solution, that's also going down pretty exponentially. And sometimes you can actually come up with ways to find what those constants are. As I said, even though you can come up with those constants, sometimes the constants don't really help you. So the question is, does this really help? Does it help to know that there are results like this that apply for any number of observations that you might have, and can you actually use them in terms of having some sort of confidence on what an optimal solution might be? Okay, so we've got these asymptotic results that apply, that say that some kind of confidence intervals might be possible if we had enough observations. We've got these other results that indicate that we get this really fast convergence to an optimal solution. However, we have those constants that we would have to estimate in order to show that or to use that in terms of coming up with any reliability estimates. So the question is, when do those asymptotic properties occur, and what are the effects? How much does dimension really affect things? I think, you know, we often talk about, like with the central limit theorem, oh, dimension doesn't really matter. However, if if you really get into trying to look at it, there is a little bit of some dependence on dimension. And does that make any difference? Does that make any difference for optimization problems, even though it doesn't make too much difference for estimation problems? Does it make any more difference for optimization than for estimation problems, than estimation problems alone? And again, are there better ways to use those observations that you have? Okay, so I'm going to put this into sort of a generic framework of maximizing some sort of expected, or in this case, minimizing. So minimizing some negative expected return plus some function of risk. So for the portfolio, I can turn the Markowitz mean variance portfolio model into something like minus a mean estimate plus some risk aversion constant times the variance. Okay, and I'm going to start off with uncertainty in different places. So uncertainty just about the mean or just about the return, and then some kind of uncertainty about the risk. And look at the different effects of just having uncertainty in the return or just having uncertainty in the risk. Now, of course, both of those are, you're going to have to estimate both of those in practice, but I want to isolate what the different effects might be for optimization problems in general. Okay, so I'm going to start off here where it's just in the return part, and the risk is just characterized by some sort of size of the allocations here. And I'm going to make it pretty simple. So the optimal solution in this case is just going to be zero, and I'm going to look at how long it takes to get to some kind of limiting distribution to the asymptotic results, and how long until I get that kind of exponential convergence that I had in those other results. Okay, so here's just this simple problem. If my data were normal to begin with, then the probability of being an epsilon distance away from optimal depends a little bit on the dimension. This is some function of this parameter on the risk term, and then the number of observations again here, which is represented by nu. And then there's some dependence on the dimension. So it does make a little bit of difference in terms of dimension, but let's look and see how much difference it makes. Okay, so this is the log that the error is bigger than something against the sample size, and I've got from dimension, this is n is 100, 1,000, and 10,000, and as you see, this is the log of the probability of some big error, and basically the asymptotic results occur when you see this becoming linear. So you could say, well, it's really fast, even up to 100 dimensions, like by 9 or 10, it's pretty linear. When I go to 1,000, it's something like 11 or 12, it becomes linear. When I go to 10,000, it's only like 16 or 17 observations, then it becomes linear. So if I didn't have to do anything with the risk, if all the estimation I had to do was in this very simple model in terms of return, then I get something like asymptotic results very quickly. It almost doesn't depend on dimension. So this is basically what we do when we talk about estimation, that estimation itself doesn't depend too much on the dimension. So you can almost ignore the effect of dimension here, that it doesn't really make too much of a difference if all you're doing is estimating the return. Okay, so there's some delay in kind of approaching these asymptotic limits to get this sort of exponential decrease in the error. It's much less, however. In fact, it's much less than linear in the dimension. It's even much less than linear in the log of the dimension. So it's very, very fast. These are good results, but could they be better? And maybe we can come up with ways to reduce the effect of dimension. One way you can reduce the effect of the dimension is to divide the samples up, and this is a sort of commonly used technique in stochastic optimization, but you divide your samples into different kinds of batches, and then you optimize over each of those batches. So I get an optimal solution for a batch where it has nu over k observations, and then I average those optimal solutions for each batch together to get my overall estimate. And the question is whether I'd do better by optimizing over some subset of the observations, or whether I do better by sort of putting them all together in one big sample. And so in particular, how much better is it going to be when I put them into batches versus putting them into one big sample? Okay, and in the portfolio estimates, this is just some information about how I would create these estimates, but I've got estimates of mean, I've got estimates of the sample variance. If I want to make sure that they're unbiased, I have to be a little bit careful, but I'll come up with some kind of unbiased estimates for both, and an unbiased estimate for the inverse of the sample variance times the mean. And then if I did it in batches, this would be the estimate for the inverse of the sample variance times mean in each of those batches. Okay, now, if I look at what's the probability of being far off when I put them into batches, I get a slightly different result from what I had before, and actually this is the size of a batch here, and then this is the dimension on the outside. Overall, the effect of the dimension is a little bit less, so I'm going to see if I can observe how much less it might be. All right, now this is, again, similar to the graph I had before. This is the number of samples. This is the log of the probability of a big error. And what I've done is here's just in 10 dimensions, and this is either splitting things up is this line, and then keeping them together is this line. And as you can see, basically by splitting them up, you get, in this case, it's sort of two orders of magnitude better at the very beginning for small samples. And as you increase the number of samples, basically, it's from this line down to this line. So it's these two lines on top are with single samples. And so if I'm to see the effect of splitting into batches, it's to go from that top line down to the third line. And actually, the difference increases in the number of samples. So as the number of samples increases, you get more and more out of splitting up your samples into more batches. In fact, it goes from something like 4 orders of magnitude down here up to 9 orders of magnitude up here. And so you can do better with the same data just by splitting it up and averaging over the optimal solutions in each of the batches that you've split the data into. Now, all of that was only had to do with estimating things here in the return. And what I'm going to look at here is sort of a simple form where I know that there's one variable, let's say the overall variance of the market, but I know the correlation structure. So the thing is, I know the correlation structure, but I just don't know how variable the market might be. So I have something to estimate here about, let's say this is the market variance, but otherwise I know everything else in terms of correlations. Now the reason for doing this is that I can do everything analytically here, so I can see exactly how badly I'll do by using some of these asymptotic estimates. In this case, the true error is given by an F distribution, and if I use the asymptotic estimate, I would get something with a chi-square distribution, and if I compare those two, I can see how badly do you do by using the asymptotic estimate compared to the analytical estimate that you get with the F distribution. Okay, so this is the difference in the probability of a given error between the asymptotic estimate and the F distribution. So basically when this says the difference in probability is 1, the asymptotic estimate says you're totally converged, where you're nowhere close to being converged. That is, there's almost no chance that you're close to an optimal solution. And then what happens as the sample size increases, and this is for different dimension problems, as the sample size increases, then the asymptotic estimate starts to take effect. So what we see here is when n is 10, the asymptotic estimate starts to take effect very quickly, maybe around 30 observations. And then it's pretty much converged by the time we get up to something close to 50. However, as we increase the dimension, there is a big effect. So the asymptotic estimate only starts to get small here for this third one, 50, around 70 samples. And when I double the dimension, then it takes somewhere around 140 samples. And if I double the dimension again, it takes somewhere around double the number of samples. So the effective dimension here the dimension makes a much bigger effect here. The convergence now is much slower, so it takes much longer to get into the asymptotic regime when I'm estimating something both in the return and in the risk, and the delay to this asymptotic convergence is almost linear in the dimension. So that dimension really does matter here. It's, again, these were not huge numbers of samples in order to get the asymptotic estimate to be close, but they start to get to the size that you might be estimating actual returns from. So it was taking somewhere on the order of 200 to 300 for the asymptotic estimate to get close to the real estimate, and that might be kind of the order that you might observe for actual asset returns. So the asymptotic distribution of the objective is sort of similar to this. And when there are multiple variance estimates, then it's going to get even worse, and I'll show you those examples next. However, I can't do it analytically, so I'm just going to show you them empirically. So here we are. So I'm going to have to estimate the entire covariance matrix. I'm going to assume that it's, there's some single covariance matrix that I'm trying to estimate. Again, some returns I'm trying to estimate. I can make an unbiased estimate of the return, but I have to adjust. The adjustment does include the dimension, so there, in coming up with an unbiased estimate here, you have to include the dimension because you're estimating everything in the dimension as well. You're estimating everything in the return space as well. But I can do a little bit in terms of trying to correct. So I'm going to give my attempt here of coming up with an unbiased estimate as much as I can. So I am going to try to come up with something that's unbiased, but just to see how big the error is. Okay, so again, do subsamples, splitting things up, improve convergence, and how do the constraints affect things. So this is just describing how the simulation is set up. And here I'm going to start with a constraint region where I don't allow any short positions. So I have 10 asset classes that I'm investing in, no short positions. And when I split things up out of, this is looking at 1,000 samples, 1,000 out of 1,000 actually are better by splitting things up than keeping them as a single sample. And this is a histogram of the probability that the batch is better. So this is the batch is closer to an optimal solution by 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%. So this is how much better, because these are all negative, how much better is splitting things into batches than doing them in a single sample, and in terms of distance to optimality, in terms of the objective. And in both cases, it's always better, because all these numbers are negative, it's always better to split things up. Now, as I allow this constraint region to increase, however, the results are somewhat different. So as I make the constraint region larger, I start to get some chances here where these numbers being positive means that actually the single sample is doing better in those observations than splitting things into batches. In this case, splitting things into batches is only better 64% of the time. On average, it's better 3% by 3% in terms of both distance optimality and the objective value. But it is worse than when I had tighter constraints. And when I basically have no constraints at all, it's actually worse. So splitting things into batches, you can see most of the histogram is to the right of zero, so that means that single sample is doing better most of the time, and in fact it does better, it's only 23% of the time does splitting into batches do better, and on average it's it's worse off, farther from optimal solution than a single sample by about 7%. Now, this is just in 10 dimensions. What I'm going to do is look at the effect in increase in dimension from 10 to 20. And here I've put everything on a single graph. So I have the blue in this case corresponds to splitting things into batches, and the red are the red is having everything as a single sample, and this is sort of the relative gap to an optimal solution. So what I'd like to have is that the blue is closer to zero than the red. And actually, in 10 dimensions, it's sort of split. It's not obvious here which is better. It's sort of slightly better for the batching, but that's not obvious because there's a lot more red down here than blue. However, in 20 dimensions, it's much better to split things into batches. So you can tell that this is distance to optimality. There's a lot more down here, a lot more blue down at the smaller error levels than there is red. So you do a lot better in terms of optimality in 20 dimensions here for this region where it was basically 50-50 at 10 dimensions. It's much better here at with 20. However, when it's an unconstrained region, when the region is very large, as I said before, a single sample does much better. You can tell the red is sort of dominant here at 10 dimensions, and it's even more dominant here for 20. So almost all the time at 20, you do better by keeping it as a single sample. The batching approach improves when the constraints do bind, but the improvement is only significant when the constraints are relatively tight. They're about, in that case, they're about 3 standard deviations from the optimum. So they weren't so tight that they were binding all the time, but it was enough that it basically it prevented very big errors. Batching can improve without constraints, but only in sort of low dimensions. It doesn't really work too well in those higher dimensions. So just to sort of summarize, when I go from 10 to 20, it actually did slightly worse for the tightly constrained region, 98% versus sort of 100%. And the objective improvement was not quite as good when I went to higher dimensions. But it did better in this region that's sort of in between, 84% of the time being better compared to 64% when n was 10. And the average improvement was something more than double what it was previously. However, it did much worse when there were basically no constraints. Okay, so that's sort of the same thing. What I want to do is talk a little bit about other things. So I sort of gave you one method to try to reduce the problem of error estimation in portfolio problems. That is, you split the data up and then optimize over different parts of it. And I'll talk briefly about some other things. I could talk about factor methods, that is, looking at dependence on factors as opposed to just covariance between different assets. But basically, you can just think of this as looking at the factors, and then you'll have to estimate something in terms of relationship to the factors. Mentioned a little bit about robust optimization, Bayesian updating, simple rules, which have been promoted in the literature lately, and then again, I'll mention something about non-normality. Okay, so robust optimization, you can just think about it. Suppose an uncertainty set, we're not sure what the parameters are. However, we know in some way that they reside in some set, say, of returns and variances. And then we're just going to minimize where we take a maximum value over the realizable returns and variances. Of course, the challenge of that is, how is the set made? Usually it's outside the model, or else maybe it's done ad hoc. And defining what kind of confidence interval you might have based on that is sometimes difficult. In general, the solution avoids assets with large uncertainty sets, And so it sets many things to zero often. And unfortunately, that leads to lack of diversification. So empirically, that may not do so well. Some other kinds of Bayesian things that people do, I'm going to use something that's similar to a Black-Litterman kind of capital asset pricing model equilibrium. So start off with assuming that there is this equilibrium model and then try to make consistent, assume that all the returns are going to be consistent with that model, but you might have some view that sort of slides your return away from what the model might say. And you might also put in some constraints, like the weights on all the assets are positive or no shorting. And in this case, again, what we might say is then that the returns are based something based on the market plus something that's sort of idiosyncratic or that might represent a view. And same thing might be true in terms of the variance matrix. And this is just describing how to update things. As I said, there are other approaches. So we could do robust optimization, that is sort of optimize and assume that there's this range of parameters that might be possible. The other way is to do robust estimation, that is to make sure that you sort of throw out anything that's that doesn't make too much sense, that's in some sense an outlier. And maybe by doing it in the estimation, then you can optimize with whatever those estimates are after you remove the outliers. So we might do robust estimation as well. Or we might just use simple rules. Now this is this paper there appeared in Review of Financial Studies where they say, you know, basically if you just put 1 over n, no matter how many assets you have, just put 1 over n in each of those asset classes, according to that paper, you do better in terms of Sharpe ratio and turnover than any of the estimation procedures that they attempted. That's what it says in the paper. Okay. I don't know. I can't get there. I can't reproduce their results. So that's why I'm not able to reproduce them. I'm not sure. Yeah. Well, for one thing, I don't think they did optimization. I think they did rounding or something, some heuristic, because I don't get anything close to their results. So. So I am going to compare on their data sets, though. So they have data sets with this Morgan Stanley index, the Morgan Stanley country indices, and then Ken French data. Ken French is from Ken French's website. And I'm going to compare some of these different procedures. So compare this 1 over n, compare an estimate that just uses a moving window. So again, these are non-stationary, so maybe a moving window makes sense. Or you might sort of go back to the example of the University of Michigan. Well, we've got a lot of data, so let's use all of it. So put in the full history. Or I used a sort of simple Gartsch model for estimating the data. And then I did a number of different strategies. So one is sort of a Black-Litterman type of strategy. Another is just putting in a constraint on no short selling. And then robust optimization, as I said, 1 over n is another strategy. This is for those examples. So these are industry portfolios, and I think this is also Morgan Stanley data. This is the Morgan Stanley International data. This is Fama French's. Just the three factors, Fama French three-factor model. These are the Fama French industrial portfolios and more of the portfolios plus more. These are just the portfolios plus the market index, and these are the Fama French portfolios plus market plus momentum. Plus the three Fama French factors plus momentum. These are Sharpe ratios. This is the 1 over n. Again, as I said, these results, even though I think I'm using the same time series, same data sets, same dates as what was in their paper. However, I don't get the same results. And I don't think I'm the only one that doesn't get the same results. So I don't know about the referees, but I don't think the referees ever checked. And they don't allow you to use their data directly. But they do say what dates they use, so I use the same dates. So they get something that, as I say, that's different. I think only on these do I get something that sort of agrees with them. So this is the 1/n strategy. These are the sharp ratios. These are monthly sharp ratios. So 0.137, 0.09, 0.235, 0.164, 0.176. However, just this moving window, I get, in this case, a sharp ratio that's like 10 times the 1/n. Now, what does this say? It says that there's obvious momentum in the data, and momentum does make a difference. So, doesn't make this much difference. I'm not sure. This is sort of the best possible. This is actually just using. This is in sample. So in sample, you could go from 0.176 to 1.76. So in sample, this, you go from 0.16 to 0.76. This in sample on the Fama French, you can't do that much better, actually. In sample on international, in sample here. So you do much better. What I have in yellow are the best overall of the ones that are done out of sample. And, in one case, this full history sort of, and well, this is no shorting. So so putting in the constraint of no shorting actually helps. And that's sort of what I was doing with those batching of samples. By removing the possibility of sort of big errors, which putting in a no short constraint does, by removing the possibility of big errors, you actually do much better in terms of optimization. And you get, within, at least in these examples, you get much higher sharp ratios. It's just the ratio of mean to variance or mean to standard deviation, taking out the risk-free returns. So in this case, you do better with the full history. However, this sort of simple Garsch model, and these are weights that I put on my prior. So this is actually not putting any weight on the CAPM prior does best, although you don't do that much worse by putting weight on the CAPM prior. And you get sort of what I think are relatively markedly better than this naive estimate. So I think you do much better than the naive estimate in general, as opposed to what is said in their paper. I think you do much better than the naive estimate, but only when you put in the constraints and when you optimize. So I don't think they actually optimize in their paper, and I think that's the reason why when you actually do optimization, it actually does make a difference. I think it does actually do better. Okay, so here's just some overall implications. I put down some things about using large sample, using all the data that you have. Well, the good thing about using large sample is you can get these convergence results. However, just using a large sample does make you susceptible to some problems with dimension if you don't put any constraints in. So because of the dimension, then the constraints can really hurt you. It might not give you quite the right kind of solution character that is to be fully diversified. And it doesn't necessarily give you a confidence interval for everything, and it might be efficient. And I put down just my view on what these others might give you. So robust has the advantage, for example, of being efficient. You might be able to construct confidence intervals if you knew something about the data, but you don't get maybe the solution characteristics that you might expect. But if you don't get full diversification, which because we know that all the prices that in the model have are positive, the market puts some positive weight on everything. So if the market puts positive weight on everything, but your model doesn't, then either you know something that the market doesn't know, or something's inconsistent. Okay, I As I said, I don't have too much, I don't have much time really at all to talk about non-normal distributions. There's a paper with a student of mine who's just started at Hopkins, Luis Chavez. We look at non-normal distributions, so this was all mean variance. So mean variance in general can be very far from optimal for different kinds of utility. What we looked at was exponential utility, and using generalized hyperbolic distributions, so it gives you a fairly broad class. The nice thing is that that class is closed under summation, so with exponential utility, it's possible to analyze it and actually come up with closed form solutions in some cases. Turns out, actually, that mean variance can be very close. So the mean variance solution, if you just do the estimates from sample, can be very close. However, you have to pick the risk aversion constant perfectly. So you really have to know what that is. It turns out that makes a difference what risk aversion parameter you put in for exponential utility. So for different risk aversion parameters, you might be really far off. But it is possible to get close, and we talk a little bit about how you might go about choosing this, choosing good risk aversion parameters in that paper. The other thing, another way to sort of reproduce different kinds of distributions is to assume a Gaussian, but then put on some sort of nonlinear function on top of the Gaussian. And that is particularly good for things like fixed income returns, where they are going to be, say, nonlinear functions of, let's say, the asset values. So particularly for very large portfolios of fixed income instruments, using these nonlinear functions is one way to be able to estimate very large data sets and solve very, very large problems. So in this case, we can solve problems in like with a million assets by estimating these nonlinear functions of some Gaussian underlying distribution. And what we do is use polynomial approximations to do that and then come up with some higher order estimates and then do the optimization over that. Okay, so some summary observation. So one thing I wanted to get across is that convergence to asymptotic behavior, even though there are these nice theoretical results, it's slower in optimization than it is with general estimation. So even if you can say an estimation, just parameter estimation, that dimension doesn't make any difference, the fact that basically when you do risk and return, you're going to be dividing by some sort of uncertain estimate, and when you divide by something that's uncertain, then you can have very large errors in what the resulting solution is. And so because of that, dimension actually makes a much bigger difference for optimization with uncertainty and risk and return than it does for estimation alone. So optimization, you know, you can have a big dimension effect. That effect is reduced when you split things up into batches. So dimension has more effect with greater uncertainty. However, splitting things into batches can improve the estimates. However, that improvement comes partly from splitting things into batches, but also partly from the constraints. So that you have to really use the constraints wisely, that they have to represent something that makes sense. And by putting in those constraints, then you can actually come up with better solutions and splitting things up into batches. And in terms of the best, at least in these data sets that we looked at, the best kind of mean variance portfolio estimates come from using some sort of Garch type estimate and then preventing large deviations by putting in the constraints. So Garch to capture dynamics, putting in constraints and then splitting things up into batches, I think is sort of the best way to go, at least for the types of things that we've tried. Okay, so there's some additional questions that I just put down, like how does the batch sample continue to improve with dimension? You know, are there general confidence interval estimates that you can form here? I think you can basically try to fit the exponential convergence to optimality that I talked about. I think you can fit those parameters from the data, and I think that's one way that you can come up with confidence estimates. Another question is how do these perform with other kind of techniques to that enhance convergence? And, you know, how do all these things go together? Estimation, non-stationarity, and non-normality. Okay, well, thank you for your attention. Maybe have some questions?